This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and this is Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In the penultimate episode of the year, I speak to Susie Byrne about her dad.
I was the one that would have been up in the box with Roisin or Colette up in the director's box, and I loved being up there. Yeah. I'd go literally on a Friday night up the little steps, and I'd sit in there, and then they'd be doing rehearsals of various things, and Dad would kind of say, "Is anybody seeing Susie?" Yeah. And went down the microphone, "She's up here," and I'd get the eyes up saying, "Now behave yourself up there," and all that. So I found that whole the direction absolutely fascinating.
So would you have been there for the iconic role at their Roisin moments?
Oh yeah.
Being the daughter of one of our best-known broadcasters, this conversation gives us an insight into the man Gay Byrne was when he was at home, from one of the people who knew him best. She also talks about a book she's compiled called Dear Gay, Letters to the Gay Byrne Show, A Handwritten History of Ireland.
Susie, it's great to meet you.
Thank you, Sheila. Lovely to meet you too. Great to be here.
And congratulations. This, I can only imagine having flicked through quickly and then gone back and read chunks of the book, how powerful it probably was for you to put this all together, to go back into the RTÉ archives, to discover these letters, and I suppose to know the impact that your dad had on the person writing the letter, the people listening, and what a massive force he was, not just in broadcasting in Ireland, but in society in Ireland, particularly during the periods of his radio show. So am I right in thinking his first show was in 1973?
Yeah.
And then it wrapped up in 1998. Yes. A lot of change in those years.
Huge, huge. Particularly in the late 70s and 80s. The 80s were really fundamental in the change that in within the letters that we found. They were the years that we really focused on, and the early 90s. But you could see in the archives, they didn't hold letters earlier than the early 1980s. So really the what we have in the late 70s is the relationship building with between him and his listeners. So it was very light, very, I wouldn't say whimsical, but it was very, the audience was stay-at-home mums, keep them amused. They're not interested in anything. They just want a bit of music and lightheartedness during the morning. And so you can see in the archives the building of that relationship of letters starting to come in, the relationship with him and the listeners.
Yeah.
Just gradually building until they, you know, there's lots of pieces within the archives of there was a shopping basket segment where they would send their team around. He would send the team around the country to various supermarkets on a weekly basis, and they would take a basket of shopping, and they would report on costs of in whether it was Dunn's or I don't think Tesco's,
Quinsworth
yeah. at the time, and even to see the lists that they had, you could see, you know, the bird's custard, or even the ambrosia creamed rice, the little yeah. all those little pears soap, all the things that we are reminded of even in yeah. ads from children,
yeah.
and that caused huge controversy within. You could see lots of legal letters where they felt then that the Retail Federation felt that the supermarkets were being given free advertising every week because the Gay Byrne Show were going around the country checking on the same basket of items.
All right.
And the supermarkets would get wind of it first and they would make lower their prices. So there was a huge controversy, but it kind of was the realization that the power of the program yeah. and the people were listening, and the fact that this simple shopping basket was causing such controversy throughout the country, and they were knocked back a lot of times by RTE management and by the retailers, Retail Federation, and told to go back. They were not a current affairs program. They were to go back to where they were supposed to be, which was in the nice little niche of entertainment and lighthearted fun. So and they did go back for a while, but then the program started to become more powerful, and then they branched out again, and they started to letters started to come in. So it kind of flowed through. So by the time the letters which are in the book came in, the relationship was there and the trust was there, and the women were listening, and they were such a huge percentage of the population at home listening.
Yeah, and let's put it into context for people listening. In terms of the listeners that he had, because, yeah. you know, every few months, you know, with the JNLRs, we find out what shows are getting what listenership, but like nothing in comparison to what Gay was getting back in the day.
Yeah, he was getting, I think the population was 3.5 million, and he was getting in and around 25% of listeners on a day-to-day basis. So there was approximately, you know, it varies a little bit, but 850,000 people listening on any
Phenomenal.
One day, which was huge.
Huge.
Huge at the time. Huge.
But we've all heard the stories. I mean, I know you've heard a million of them, but we have as well, where, you know, people's day was built around
Absolutely.
Getting Gay in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
And it was originally the Gay Byrne hour
until 1979. And then they increased it to 2 hours, which gave him, and that's why I think that when you see all these letters and all of the conversations that started to emerge, because it was then a 2 hour program, there was time. They could still have, it was still very much fun and lighthearted. It wasn't like they had 2 hours of hard hitting stories. I mean, you can see in the running orders within the archives, how they jumped from very, very serious topics to Christmas cakes and various things, even after in some instances where there had been an incident in Northern Ireland or something, and that was covered, but then they came back off a break and they had to move to something very light. So the 2 hours gave them that opportunity, which was great.
How did this come about for you?
It came about because Dad died in November 2019, and RTE wanted to do something to recognise his contribution to broadcasting. And when they looked at what had been done before, there wasn't all of the programme. There was a programme called Gaybo, which he contributed to after he retired from the Late Late. And there'd been various things done. So it was when they kind of figured that really nothing had ever been done on the radio program. It had all been the Late Late, and it had all been all of that, because that was easier, it was visual. The radio program, although it was recognised as huge, had never really been investigated. So when they went into the archives, it's Sarah Ryder in RTE, who's a phenomenal woman.
Yeah,
she's a powerhouse, and she very quickly said, this is the letters. It's all going to be the letters.
Yeah.
So she did a documentary in 2020, and I helped her out with that quite significantly at the time. But even at that time, when she was editing, she had a technically an hour long documentary, which was 52 minutes once ads and everything were taken in. And she couldn't really as she said herself, she only tipped the iceberg of what she knew was there.
Yeah.
So Michael Gill then of Gill Books came out to me for a cup of coffee one day and he just said to me, there's a book, there's a big book and would you do it? So I thought about it, not for very long, to be honest, because my youngest daughter, Saoirse, was starting secondary school. So I was working part time at the time and the timing was just right.
Yeah,
so I just
had a bit more space.
I had a bit more space to do it. And I just thought, why not? It can't be. Sarah's kind of been in there. She knows what's in there. And I knew by my contribution to the documentary, I was fascinated by the whole thing because, again, I'm sure like yourself, the Gayburn show was massive in our lives as a child, but we were also at school all the time. So the Late Late Show was probably more visual to us.
Yeah, that's very true.
As our family.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we knew the SIG tune and if we were sick at home or holidays, it was that in Harbour Hotel. They were the two signature tunes you kind of knew.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was just fascinated by it. So I started in I went and then I had no idea what I was getting myself involved in. It was much bigger than I thought. Huge.
And I suppose this is where the archive in RT is really incredible.
It is. It's incredible. Mm. Absolutely. And when I went in, it was at the tail end of COVID, so there was nobody in there. And to get into RT archives was the most extraordinary feat. And then eventually I got in there and this little wonderful man, Robert Carty, he was incredible. He literally knew the place inside out and backwards. He knew everything and he would take all the files out for me. I'd be given the white gloves and in I went and I spent days in there and it was very overwhelming because it's all handwritten letters. So you're trying to
decipher sometimes.
And then I ended up with way too much information, way too much too many letters rather. And so
I was culling it hard.
Culling was very difficult. So Alice O'Sullivan, who worked on the Gayburn show with Dad for years and years and then went on to produce an RTE, she helped me.
Great.
I called her up and she was fabulous. And so we sat down together because my fear a little bit was I got very overwhelmed with it. And
because you're so close to it too.
You're so close to it. And I probably started a little bit too soon after Dad died because I found very emotional to see his handwriting and comments that he would have made, but that would have been very much in his kind of dry sense of humour. And I mean, I was laughing. And then you go down rabbit holes where you could be hours fascinated by something and leave RTE at the end of the day with nothing really to show for it.
Yeah.
But anyway, Alice and myself kind of we looked at them again and again and then we said, okay, what we'll do is we'll take out anything that isn't directly somebody's story. So there's so many letters and I think this and I guess it's happening in my area and all of this and I know this and I know that. But then we were able to see, okay, well, let's just keep it to this happened to me. And that immediately culled so many things. So we kept that within, and apart from the Northern Ireland chapter, it pretty much follows that that path throughout the book.
I was saying to you just before we started to record that, you know, I think any of us who have worked in broadcasting, whether it's radio or telly, we've all heard the Gayburn stories because your dad was an icon. And, you know, he had an incredible work ethic, certainly preparing and honouring whoever he was going to talk to, whether it was an author, he would have read the book. He
Absolutely.
Was a big believer in doing all this prep. And I think then the beauty of it was when you heard him talking to someone, it was effortless.
Yes.
It was this sense of, I can now let it go because I know it all.
Yeah.
And he was very laid back in his approach. And that's probably the beauty because he put all the work in.
Yes. Oh, huge preparation. Huge. I remember actually when Salman Rushdie wrote his book, The Satanic Verses, years and years ago now, he wrote a piece inside the book to Dad and he said, thank you for being the first person who actually read the book that had interviewed him, that he wasn't. So he was able to jump around, you know, if a story, he was able to, because he read all the books, because he prepared so hugely for everything that he did, he made it look effortless.
Yeah.
But it also meant that if somebody was going on a story and he just found that he could change direction of interviews very easily because he had the material and he'd read everything, which was amazing.
Amazing. I remember hearing it when myself and my sister had a TV show for a year in RT, a daytime TV show. And I remember, you know, the researchers would be mm-hmm. giving us our briefs, and somebody who had experience, you know, a more senior person on the team who'd had experience of working
yeah.
on a gay team was kind mm-hmm. of saying, you know, he was a stickler for research being done correctly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And the information to be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody had to be on board.
Yeah.
So the team were a well-oiled machine.
Massively. And you can see that actually when you go into the archives and you go into the daily programme files, the work that went into each
yeah.
programme, which was not him. I mean, it was the work that he was given. They were an incredible team. And, you know, anyone that wrote a letter to him that was going to be read out on air, every letter was typed out fully, and then the original behind it, so that there was no room for a letter or a name to be read out or a place or anything that if somebody didn't want it to be. Mm. So you can see, I mean, and little newspaper clippings and interview notes and preparation. I mean, they were a very hardworking team. He relied on them massively, but they were great.
So many bits of the book jumped out to me, but I loved this that you have written down in the book. You said in an interview with Olivia O'Leary, Dad himself said, to be able to listen, a broadcaster must allow silence.
Mm-hmm.
Leave people a moment or two to get their thoughts together.
Yeah.
I mean, even now, and he's no longer alive, mm-hmm. I'm learning from that.
Yes, yes.
As somebody who likes to talk
mm-hmm.
to people.
Mm.
And I think a lot of us fear silence.
Yes.
Because I suppose you're trained as well, like, you know, if you're in radio, mm-hmm. you can't have silence. Mm-hmm. But actually, the most powerful moments can come from those quiet moments.
Yeah, because people suppose their train of thought is just yeah. a little bit behind, or they're nervous, or if you know your interviewee, you can see that there's something coming, and you're trying yeah. to relax them down. But yeah. he did that, because even in later years, like my mother would say to you that it just interviewers interrupting drove him insane.
Yeah,
he would just be like, just listen. You're not listening.
You're not listening.
You're not. This is not going well. You're not. Please stop interrupting. Yeah. He'd be talking to the radio, talking to himself. Oh my God, turn it off. They're not listening.
Yeah.
Or he'd have somebody. He'd say, yeah, they don't listen. They don't listen. So, you know.
And he's so right.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and I think a lot of us, we've become very discerning, I think, as listeners, because we're consuming a lot of whether it's podcasting or mm-hmm. interviews in lots of different forms. And I think a lot of us know instinctively the hosts that we gravitate towards are the ones usually that let the guests speak, you
yes,
know.
Yeah.
That's what he did so mm-hmm. brilliantly. But of course, you know, we're talking about Gay Byrne, the broadcaster. Mm-hmm. But to you, he was dad.
To me, he was dad, yes. Yes.
So
yes.
Let's talk about the dad.
The dad.
You know, and I know because, you know, you sent me some info, which was really helpful. Mm-hmm. I was so glad you did. But you actively didn't go into broadcasting
yes.
because I suppose not alone was your dad in broadcasting, but your mum was as well. Mm-hmm. So you had it on both sides.
Yes.
So yeah. Were you like, not for me?
Yes, I think I was quite quiet as a teenager and young adult. And which people think is hilarious now because I don't seem to ever stop talking. But they never encouraged it. And broadcasting, I guess, when we were growing up, because mum and dad were both involved in the business, had no big shine about it. It wasn't like it wasn't about being famous, I guess.
Yeah.
It was very much the job
the work
that he was doing, and it was very hard. And I mean, we got great benefits out of it. There's no doubt about that. But it wasn't all shiny and fabulous. It was hard work.
Mm.
And they never encouraged it, not discouraged it, but it just never came up. My
yeah.
sister would have been more inclined to do that kind of thing than me. She was very much involved in the Late Late Show, in the minding of the guests, looking after people. She worked in there for a long time. Then she went on and did some stage management at Riverdance and various things. Whereas I was the one that would have been up in the box with Roisin and Colette, up in the yeah. director's box. And I loved being up there.
Yeah.
I'd go literally on a Friday night up the little steps, and I'd sit in there, and then they'd be doing rehearsals of various things. And Dad would kind of say, "Is anybody seeing Susie?"
Yeah.
And down the microphone, "She's up here." And I'd get the eyes up saying, "Now behave yourself up there," and all that. So I found that whole, the direction
yeah.
Absolutely fascinating.
So would you have been there for the iconic Roll It There, Roisin moments?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Stop it.
Yeah, we were very lucky, myself and Crona, maybe because it was just the two of us. But we were in and out of RTE all the time. I mean, yeah. I remember we would just be roaming around RTE, really. When I think back, and we were taught very much how to behave.
Yeah.
We knew when the red light was on, silence. We knew we would often be standing at the side of the set, or like me up in the director's box, and we just knew we were told how to behave. But at the same time, we lived in there. I mean, we were there. We were always made very welcome. So even though people would say to you, "Oh my God, your dad must have never been there. He never, your childhood was, you know, he was gone all the time." But we were very lucky because we saw him on the television every Friday. Yeah. And we were actively encouraged. Well, I would say encouraged. We were actively welcome in RTE to the point that we knew all of the teams and both Late Late and the Gay Byrne Show. And even still, they all knew us growing up and everything. Sure, I remember myself and my friend, we found when we were very young, because the security guard went absolutely mad, we found Wanderley Wagon.
The actual Wanderley Wagon.
Oh
my goodness.
We were so excited. We ran up the steps of it and then he opened it, and of course it was black inside. There was nobody. There was no...
And I remember, childhood shattered.
Shattered. I'll never forget it because... And then the security guard obviously saw us and came running over, got really close to us, and we ran. But it was a moment where we had found Wanderley Wagon and then off we went, and it wasn't anything like we thought. So anyway.
Trauma.
A bit of trauma, clearly.
So when your dad was in work mode, like when he had the suit on, like did you feel like there was a different persona, or was he still the same dad that you knew at home, you know, sitting around the dinner table?
There was a different persona insofar as he was very focused, never stressed, or like you'd never go in. Like you could go into the dressing room before the Late Late Show, put your head around the door, and he would just be in there and he would just be going through the running order, going through the guests in his head. But he'd never say get out or anything. You'd just say anything, or he'd say just, "I'm just doing my running order," and you'd leave. There was never any impatience with us.
Mm.
So I think he was slightly different, but not he was always very calm about the whole thing. I mean, my mum even said that the only time she really saw him really rattled was up in OMA when he turned on the Christmas lights, which I have in the book. That was the only time she ever saw him break down and not have that ability to perform as he would.
Well, let's talk about that part of the book now then. Because you do, there's a whole section on Northern Ireland. And obviously that was something that you wanted to include. It was very important to include.
Very. And very difficult to know how to include it because Northern Ireland is such a hugely divisive and complicated topic that you could never do it any real service in a book like this. So... what we decided to do was, myself and Alice, when we were looking at it, we decided that we would just focus on one event, being Enniskillen. Mm. I do mention OMA as well, but Enniskillen was 1987, and there was a huge outflow of, obviously, of grief and letters. But the letters, weirdly, at after OMA, people weren't writing as many letters in 98, and so whereas in Enniskillen 1987 they were, and the outpouring of letters was huge after Enniskillen. So that's why we decided to just keep Enniskillen as the main atrocity within the book, and to just demonstrate or illustrate the kinds of letters they received after, and they received those kinds of letters after so many. Both on both sides, not just on when there was an IRA bombing, on both sides of the fence. So that was why we chose Enniskillen, and with reflection on OMA as well. I mean, the OMA bombing and the Late Late Show that was done after OMA was a huge Late Late Show, and massively had a huge effect on my dad and my mum, and obviously everybody. But I think that at that point, they had what I believe now is that the Late Late Show really covered Northern Ireland all over the Troubles so many times and in its format, whereas the radio program is much more colloquial, much more local, much more about what's happening in my house and my world.
Yeah.
And while the letters came in always after Northern Ireland or anything that happened in Northern Ireland, it didn't feature as hugely in the radio programme as it did on Late Late Show. So that, but yet it is very much still there. And so that was a reason that we have put it in there. I've put it in there the way I did, just to focus on Enniskillen.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
What's been your favorite part of the book process? Or do you have a particular letter that really, I suppose, landed with you, resonated with you?
I think there's a letter around the Anne Lovett time, which really I found to be a phenomenal letter. There's so many, but insofar as the book kind of traces the social history of the country. And I think in the context of looking back, you can, hindsight is everything, but while we all knew about the unfairness and the discrimination against women, and in hindsight we know it all, we've read it all so many times, the letters showing how deliberately women were kept ignorant of their own bodies, of pregnancy, of sex, of everything. And then when they got pregnant, whether it was through love or through incest or rape, of which it was many times, they were then punished so much further for that, which is extraordinary. And to hear they're writing about this and how ignorant they were, and they're actually, for their own words, and how articulate and how beautifully they wrote, and the risks that they took to write. Those letters, I really, really affected me hugely, because they're kind of throughout the book.
Yeah.
And
they often say, please don't read out my name or read out my address or whatever, don't they?
Yeah. And the unfairness and the ignorance. There's a letter which is really upsetting, which talks about a girl who knew nothing, who had been, was being interfered with. She was 11 and she knew nothing. She knew nothing about pregnancy. She knew nothing. She was the oldest of, I think, 10. So she had never seen her mother in any, ever pregnant. She had not. There was 9 children that came behind her. They were pretty much ignored. She didn't really associate. She didn't know where they came from.
Okay.
She never saw her mother being thin or large. Her mother was always the same kind of size.
Yeah.
And she never, the Virgin Mary never got fat, as she said. So there was no, she had no correlation between getting pregnant and a baby or anything. And she carried around money in her bag for twopence to get into a bathroom to clean up after herself if she had a baby in the middle of the street and she thought she was pregnant. She hadn't even had her first period. Oh. And just the sheer silence of not knowing anything. And she had never, I think for 2 years she was the life and soul of the party and doing it, but carrying around this burden of what she was going to do with this baby if when she was because she was she thought she was pregnant, and yet she'd never even had a period. So she just had no idea.
God, that's so sad.
So there's
it's
lots
so sad.
Of those.
And it's so scary, isn't it?
It's so scary. And there's lots of those kinds of letters or alcoholism. There's a theme of just, you know, there's unemployment, alcoholism, marriage, silence in marriages throughout. But at the same time, then you have to remember that this wasn't a spill all the beans program. At the same time, there was happiness and joy and fun stuff. So the letters of the week and a lot of those things that we've in there as well, they're very funny.
Yeah, sure. Of course they are. And there are some brilliant ones. But it is that feeling, I suppose, on the serious topics of the power that shame had.
The shame.
Yeah. And I mean, we still unfortunately need to do more work on it. But it was so dramatic, I suppose, during those years.
Yeah.
And I think that's what your dad seemed to be fearless in terms of topics that he wanted to tackle. And, you know, I'd say it's fair to say that he was a feminist.
I think he was feminist, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think he surrounded himself. He knew his audience.
Yeah.
He also was, I think first and foremost, he was a broadcaster and that's all he ever wanted to be. And so he recognised what was being listened to and what was required and what people wanted to hear. So he was fearless, I think, in John Cadden, his producer, on the day after Dad died, there was a late special to him, and in the audience John Cadden, who was his producer at that time, said that the one word that he would say would be that he would remember him as his courage, where behind the scenes he was fighting. I mean, he was being hauled up in front of management day in, day out, being told, stop, you've got to stop this. And he had to keep fighting to be able to do what he was doing. And I think he surrounded himself. There was lots of women in his, obviously in his home and also within the team who were teaching him things about what was going on with women and the unfairness. And his audience were women. So he knew that he was actually broadcasting to his audience. So he was able to, I think he was able to ask the hard questions because he had the letters. He knew what was going on and people had written to him. So when he was being kind of pushed back and told not to ask questions, he just went on ahead and did it because he knew that the listeners wanted it, and they did. And they kept writing and more and more. It was great. It was great for us all.
If it's okay to ask, and feel free not to answer, just with the current situation on RT and what's been happening over the past few months, you can't answer for somebody who's no longer here.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think you might know what his take would be on all the carry on?
I think he would have, first of all, I think he would have been deeply, deeply upset about the whole thing. His loyalty to RTE was huge, despite having I would say, worked in an organization like RTE for so many years and so long.
And he gave so much of himself.
He did, and he suffered hugely on so many levels within RTE, and he knew the ins and outs, and he knew the weaknesses within RTE. And I think he would be deeply upset for the people working in RTE, because I think he had huge loyalty to the teams that worked. You know, when I think back to our childhood when we were adults, and those in the from the reception desk on RTE to security guards to the cameraman to the floor managers, his relationship was huge, and he knew them all. They were a family. They were quite small at that stage. And the work that he demanded massive, massive work from his teams. So he would have recognised that the work that went into the programmes.
Yeah.
And I think that in later years, he would have probably watched television more than he did after he retired. And so programmes like, I'm going to say, Nationwide, or programs that probably would not be box office on any day of the week, but are so important to so many people, and will never. It's like the bus routes around the country that don't really earn anything, but yet without them,
it would
be tragic.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think he would be kind of probably a bit angry, quite angry, but I think he probably would have spoke out probably quite a bit over. I often wondered over the summer, would he have just said his piece, because he wasn't one for not saying his piece.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the people within, the people that they're hard, that down on the ground, that like the makeup girls and all those people that provided, you know, everything for everybody.
Yeah.
All throughout the years, all those people that are always end up suffering.
That's right. Yeah.
So hard to know what he would have said, but I think he would have been very upset.
Yeah. I hope it's okay that I sprung that on
that's
you.
Fine.
But at the beginning of the chat, I handed you your dedication at the beginning, and I asked, would it be okay if you might read it out? Because I just thought it was gorgeous and really encapsulated everything really about the book and how special it is. It's really beautiful, all the photos that are featured as well. But your dedication at the beginning is lovely. So if you wouldn't mind doing us the honour of reading it out. Absolutely.
Okay. For all those who put pen to paper to write to Gay, and in particular for those who had the courage to share difficult stories at a time when so many remained unspoken, your letters and stories changed Ireland for the better. We all owe you a debt of gratitude. For Gay, the broadcaster, who gave so many the platform to speak, and in doing so, lifted us all higher. For Dad, whom we loved beyond measure. As children, you made us feel part of your broadcasting world, but you also protected us from the painful realities you were uncovering. For Mum, his and our rock throughout it all. Without you, none of this would have been possible. Finally, for Ronan, Cian, Sive and Saoirse, you are my world.
And Ronan is obviously your husband, and your kids are Cian, Sive and Saoirse. How have you been since your dad passed away in 2019?
Good. We were, you know, Dad was 85 when he died, and we were very privileged that we nursed him for 3 years when he was sick, and he was a fabulous patient. When I say fabulous, he was so willing for everyone to do what they could for him, and so unwilling to be a cancer victim. He never wanted to have anything to do with, whenever I'd say to him, oh, there's a discussion on cancer in the radio, and he'd just say, don't do that again. I'm not listening to that. I'm just going to just do what I have to do. I'm going to take the pills I'm told to take, and I'm going to live my life as best I can. So he was phenomenal like that, and just old school, get up and get on with it and we'll go. So I think by the time that he died, for the last 3 months, I suppose, like anybody with cancer, you look at them and you think, you know, this is horrible. This is awful for you. For us, we'd have you forever, but his time had kind of come. So since then, we were phenomenally lucky because Dad died in November, and we gave him a beautiful send off. We had him at home. He died in our house in Howth. We were all there. We had a magnificent full week with him in Howth, and we were there when he died. And was 5 months later than COVID hit, and it's hard to believe that he never knew what COVID was. I mean, it was just extraordinary. So,
and the impact that it had on people who lost loved ones during that time,
and we our life was normal. We did the normal things, and so many people weren't able to do that. So, we miss him dreadfully because he was such a central, obviously, part of everything that we did, and we are a small family. And we were very close in that we always did holidays together in the last few years, probably 10 years. We lived in London for a long time. Himself and Mum would come over with friends. They'd come over just themselves. We just lived together a lot. So the first year was really hard. Harder, I think, than I thought it would be, even though logically you're saying, you know, 85, so many people lose people younger. You know, we had him, for all the right reasons, we were it was fine. But then you miss them dreadfully.
Yeah.
And I think because of who he was, he's constantly in the news. He was for that year. He was every reeling back the years. You think, there he is again. You'd hear his voice on things. So it was a bit strange that you kept seeing him, even though obviously we were used to that. But suddenly it was a bit harder. But now, I mean, he's 4 years dead now, and still we still miss him. But at the same time, you know. Our memories are so good. We had such fabulous memories, which is an incredible thing to be able to say. Not everybody can. So I think I think the mind is amazing. I was just saying to somebody last week, because it was his anniversary last week, about how, like anything, you forget all the bad things, all the sickness, all the kind of bits where he was really not well. And you just remember the good things and the good fun and the laughs and the stories, and you hear a bit of music and we all smile and we laugh and we're always telling stories, and everyone has a story about Dad, which is great. We're so lucky that so many people knew him, which is fantastic.
And he has such an impact on so many people.
Yeah. And even you see people, there was a lecture a couple of weeks ago, Gabriel Memorial lecture from the Broadcasting Society, and the photographer that was there, lovely man, and he came over to me and he said, you know, in all the years, all the way down through the years, your father was always so phenomenal to photographers, always giving them time, appreciating that they needed to take a photograph, asking them, did they get what they needed every time? And he said it was such a lovely thing to say, you know, not everybody can say that, or people sometimes can be quite rude to people like that. So people always say nice things.
Yeah.
We're very lucky. Thank God.
Yeah, sure. Anytime I ever met him, like, you know, within RTE as well, you were always kind of going, you're in the presence of greatness, it's Gabriel. You're always trying to kind of be cool. It's Gabriel. But he was always extremely warm. And I think he probably sensed people instinctively being, even though his nature wasn't to intimidate, but because of who he was, he would sometimes bring about that sense of, it's Kay.
Yeah.
You know, but he was always very warm and instantly would work at putting you at ease, which again reflected back to the type of person he was, that there was just a lot of, I suppose, compassion and understanding.
Yeah. I think he'd been in RTE since forever. So many people had known him all of that time, and he knew faces, and he knew everybody around the place. And I remember he had a car space outside the Late Late Show office, and which we always presumed was his. And he's absolutely not. I come in, I'm the first in there. I park there. If I go out to lunch, he had a cone in the back of his boot, and he would put the cone on the space and then go off for lunch and come back. And this, obviously, the cone, nobody moves the cone. That was his parking space.
Oh, my goodness. I love it.
Just like everybody else. He just happened to be in first, so got the space, and I always went for the same space. So it looked like it was his.
That's a great story. Because anyone who knows RT, like, I know it's changed, but like certainly getting a parking space in there is always one of those
gold dust.
Yeah, gold dust. But so I know you could be asked, like, what are your favorite memories? And I'm sure there are plenty of memories that come to mind. But in terms of a quality that your dad had, or a way he made you feel, rather than, you know, Gay the broadcaster, but him as a dad, what comes to mind when you think of him?
He was a man that he loved being at home. We knew when he came home in the evening
that was a sanctuary.
He loved being there. And I think people often, when mum and dad bought their house in Howth, which was probably about nearly 60 years ago now, it was in the middle of nowhere, and there was absolute, what are you doing? But actually, over the years, Howth was his sanctuary. And the drive out to Howth, when there was no mobile phones, nothing, he literally would have that silence of 30 minutes when, you know, people often say, like, how come was he really affected by all of the things that are in these letters and etc. But I think he decompressed coming out to Howth, came home, went for a walk for about 40 minutes every evening, and loved being there. He just sank into the big chair, and we were little girls or teenagers chit-chatting around the place, and just that noise, he loved it.
Yeah.
And I think one of the, I suppose, the annual events for us, and which was a huge event in our family life every year was the Christmas Eve radio programme. Mm. Because in order to get to take the week off after Christmas, he had to record all of the Rick Gabriel show programmes between Christmas and New Year. Usually he had to record a Late Late Show or two, and so that he could actually take a 10 days. So everything had to be backed up. So by the time it came to Christmas Eve, the programme was on in Grafton Street, near well, it moved around, but pretty much around the Bewleys area. And we would dress up and we'd be all dressed up and we would hear him on the radio, and you'd hear all that lovely, lively, everyone was chatting and there was all the songs going on and the talent and everything. And so we would be driving in, listening to him on the radio, and then we'd get in there in our little pretty dresses and our coats, and he would finish. And at the time we used to go around to Peter's Pub with the Rayburn Show crew, and they'd all have Irish coffees. And then we'd go for family lunch. And later years, we used to go into the Westbury then. And it was just that feeling of it's Christmas.
You'd switch off.
And he himself was so relaxed. It was the only day he was ever in town, really. We would never have gone down Grafton Street. But on Christmas Eve, he wanted to walk up and down Grafton Street. And we'd go down and always wanted to buy myself and Crona a gift from him. So we would go in and we might get a little bracelet or something. And but people were always greeting him all the way up and down the street. And there was just that lovely atmosphere. And the lovely flower sellers were always, "How are you gay? Are you gay?" And this, that. And they'd all come over to us. And it was a gorgeous memory. And then we'd go home and we would be in the house, and we would always go to midnight mass then in the little convent down the road. And that was Christmas, and we loved Christmas Eve. Was this day, magical day. Never, Christmas Day was obviously always Christmas Day and it was lovely, but Christmas Eve was magical in our house. It was great. We loved
That's gorgeous.
It was great.
Susie, it's been really lovely.
Thank you.
To speak
Thank
to you. Yeah, I think it's a beautiful book.
Thank you very much.
Really gorgeous. So well done. It's obvious amount of work that has gone into it. Mm-hmm. It's a stunning reflection of not just your dad's work, but Ireland of its time. And I think it's a really important piece of work and a beautiful way of marking him and his legacy. And, you know, 4 years on from his passing, it's a wonderful thing to have done for him too.
Thank you.
So well done.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's been gorgeous.
It's been great. It's been a privilege, I think, to be honest.
Yeah. Best of luck with
Thank
it.
Thank you.
It's Dear Gay, Letters to the Gay Byrne Show, A Handwritten History of Ireland. Thanks a million.
Thank you, Sheila.
Next week will be my last episode before I take a break for Christmas, and it's one not to miss. Thanks so much for listening to Ready to Be Real.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.